From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why do some people find hope despite facing serious illness? And can a hopeful attitude change the course of illness? We talk with Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of The Anatomy of Hope. He writes about medical issues for The New Yorker and teaches at Harvard Medical School. Also, we talk with one of the 2 million Muslim pilgrims now performing the Hajj in Mecca. Faiza Amba is a journalist of Saudi descent who is keeping a journal of her pilgrimage for the Christian Science Monitor. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Tenor 88, the pseudo-documentary about a fictional presidential candidate running in the primaries. It's being rebroadcast with updates on the Sundance Channel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. From NPR, as of this hour, the polls are closed in South Carolina, the first of 7 states to complete its presidential preference primary or caucus today. Exit polls show Senator John Edwards of North Carolina the winner, with Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts in second place. Activist Al Sharpton may finish third. The other candidates were clustered together, but far back of the leaders. South Carolina will allocate 45 delegates among the candidates based on today's vote. It was the first state to vote in the South, and as such was closely watched. Missouri has the most delegates at stake in today's rounds of primaries and caucuses, but as Missy Shelton of member station KSMU reports, voter turnout in the state is difficult to predict.
Before Congressman Dick Gephardt pulled out of the race, Missouri election officials had predicted that 23% of all registered voters would go to the polls. But Missouri Secretary of State Matt Blunt says it's hard to say what Dick Gephardt's withdrawal means.
Many folks that were loyal to Congressman Gephardt and would have been highly motivated to participate may not feel that same urgency with his withdrawal, but obviously the fact that Missouri became a much more competitive state required the visits of several presidential candidates has ginned up a lot of interest, so I think there's a chance that we'll exceed that 23% prediction.
Last week, Missouri received visits from Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, North Carolina Senator John Edwards, and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. For NPR News, I'm Missy Shelton in Jefferson City, Missouri.
As investigators search a Senate office building where the deadly toxin ricin was found yesterday, federal officials are confirming that a letter addressed to the White House and containing ricin was intercepted at an off-site mail handling facility in early November. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The White House isn't commenting on this, but law enforcement officials speaking on condition of anonymity confirmed to NPR that the letter containing a fine powdery substance was detected at the mail facility and that it never reached the White House. The substance tested positive for ricin, the same toxin that was found Monday in the office of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. However, one source told NPR that in the case of the White House letter, it was determined there was no public health risk because of the low potency and the granular form of the substance. The official said this is the only White House-bound letter containing the substance that has been found. The source would not say which mail handling facility this involved, but stressed that there was no threat to the public. Don Gagne, NPR News. The White House.
Officials in Connecticut say experts are testing a coarse gray powder found leaking out of an envelope addressed to the Republican National Committee. So far, investigators say there are no indications of any link to the powder found in the Senate office building. In stocks today, the Dow gained 6 points to close at 10,505. The NASDAQ was up 3 to close at 2066. This is NPR News. A former assistant stockbroker testified today that he was ordered to pass an illegal stock tip to home decorating guru Martha Stewart just before she unloaded her shares in ImClone Systems. Douglas Faneuil, the prosecution's star witness, said he told Stewart that the family of ImClone founder Sam Waxall was trying to sell its shares. Faneuil said he was ordered to alert Stewart by his boss, Merrill Lynch broker Peter Bukanovic. Stewart is on trial for insider stock trading and lying to investigators. Blacks and Hispanics are much more likely to be pulled over by law enforcement officers in Texas, according to a study that collected data from hundreds of law enforcement agencies. Janet Heimlich reports.
The report was put together by the Texas Criminal Justice Reform Coalition, the American Civil Liberties Union, the NAACP, and the League of United Latin American Citizens. It looked at data gathered by law enforcement officers as mandated by a 2001 racial profiling state law. Among its findings, about three of every four law enforcement agencies reported stopping blacks and Hispanics more often than whites. Also, nearly all the departments reported searching minorities more than whites following routine traffic stops. The study comes on the heels of an investigation conducted by the Austin American-Statesman. The newspaper looked at encounters by Austin police officers over the last 5 years and found that they were much more likely to use force on blacks and Hispanics than whites. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
Stock prices closed very slightly higher today on Wall Street. The S&P 500 gained a fraction to close at 1,136. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, writes about medical issues for The New Yorker. He's also a professor at the Harvard Medical School and is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Another important credential that helps him understand healthcare is his experience as a patient dealing with pain. He had a back injury in 1979, a ruptured lumbar disc that left him in bad pain. His subsequent surgery only made matters worse. As we'll hear a little later, he lived with pain for about 19 years. His new book, The Anatomy of Hope, considers two questions. Why do some people find hope despite facing severe illness, while others do not? And can hope actually change the course of a malady, helping patients prevail? When you were a student, you were working with a doctor who was treating a woman whose cancer had spread to the liver. You were working with this woman, too. Once cancer has spread to the liver, usually the person doesn't have too long to go. But that's not what the doctor told this woman. What did he tell her? You described this in your book.
Well, I was learning, as you say, cancer medicine. The senior physician sort of set the path. And he used medical jargon with this woman and with her daughter. He used the word, he said the chemotherapy could be effective against the tumor. That she might have a remission. And that's factually true. But when people hear that, they think that means a cure, that the cancer could be totally eradicated. So what we were doing was really sidestepping the truth and giving her misinformation or incomplete information and regrettably false hope. And then it all blew up in our faces.
What happened?
Well, she became ill, as often happens, and it was clear that we had misled her. She kept her anger quiet, but her daughter was very bitter. And she said something to me, which has never left me. And she said, you know, you didn't trust the fact that we could cope with this. You didn't give us the opportunity to hope. And I think that I felt ashamed. I know I felt ashamed at that time. And it jarred me, and it showed me that there is no easy formula in terms of speaking to people about this, balancing the truth with hope.
What did she mean that you didn't give her a chance to hope? You gave her a lot of hope. It was false hope, but you gave her hope.
Well, I think what she meant was that she wanted to understand what she could hope for, what was realistic. Could she hope for a remission of months or perhaps a year or two? And also, I think when people have that kind of knowledge, the focus of their hope can shift. They can shift it away from the body and more to the spirit or the soul, if we can use those words, that they can focus on their relationships with loved ones, if they're religious, their relationship with God, and they can seek hope to repair things in their lives which need fixing in the time they have.
There's another issue with people with cancer. If you're giving them false hope for a cure, and if they go through chemotherapy that is going to give them horrible side effects, and if there's no chance of that chemotherapy really lengthening their life in any meaningful way, then you're ensuring that the end of their life is going to be miserable.
Absolutely. I think that it's a complex issue. Some people I've cared for will say, I don't want this. I don't want to suffer or to take the risk of suffering if it's not going to extend my life, or if it's going to extend my life only for a matter of a month or two. I'd rather use that time, as much time as I have, for other purposes. And yet, as I write in the book, you have to be careful also not to rob someone of the right to resist. One of my colleagues at the hospital, and a very esteemed pathologist who's the world's expert in stomach cancer, developed stomach cancer, which, according to the textbook, is incurable. And I wasn't his doctor, but along with the other young cancer specialists on the staff, basically said, you know, I would recommend he not have any treatment. He should just go home and die, basically. And if my advice had been followed, he would be dead. And he had that small but finite response where he actually was cured. And he's alive 20 years later.
Now, when you think about that case, do you think, oh, it's because of the hope that he had, it's because of his will and his struggle? Or do you think he's that, like, you know, 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1 million who, through a combination of things, is the one that survives?
I think that without hope, you're lost, meaning that you don't have the courage to try or the resilience to endure. But hope is not a magic wand. It's not, I'm going to think positively and my tumor will melt, or I'm going to feel good and my lupus will go into remission, something like that. It's not magic. There are biological effects to hope. But as you say, and I think correctly, many, many people who have tremendous hope don't succeed, at least in a physical way. They don't. Hope is not an automatic guarantee for a cure.
When you're delivering a bad diagnosis to a patient, how does your sense of the importance of hope, reasonable hope, affect the way you give the diagnosis?
It's central to it. I think that what I do is I lay out truthfully two scenarios. I always begin with the bad scenario. I say, we all know that there can be a worst case, that things may not work out, that the disease might not remit, the drugs may not work. We need to acknowledge that. And yet, there is a real possibility that we could prevail, and we'll do everything possible to get there so that the hope is real. And then you wait for the person to respond. Sometimes someone is so shocked and unnerved by the news that they're mute. And it's important in situations like that, I routinely encourage someone else to be by them so that they can ask the questions or engage more in discussion. Sometimes we need a second visit to go over what we talked about the first time and to reinforce the fact that there really is a chance, that there really is hope.
Now, the story that you were telling us about the doctor you were studying with when you were a med student who gave the woman with cancer false hope, he eventually got cancer himself, a rare form of cancer that starts in the bile ducts. And he was going to forego any treatment because he thought it was hopeless. And when a doctor told him to try, he'd say, hey, I play that game with my patients, but I'm too smart for that.
But he did.
So why did he decide finally to go through with chemo, or was it radiation?
It was radiation, and I think that he had to come to terms with the fact that there was a real chance. It was not clear. The odds were against him, but it was a possibility, and that there was a reason for him to try. He had a very close relationship with his wife. He was very gratified by his work. And I think that he had a sense that there was no hope because he had no possibility of control over his circumstances. And yet, in fact, he did. And the surgeon who cared for him had to bring him to that realization, which is not an easy thing to do. But it taught me how difficult it is for people to find hope in dire circumstances. But when hope is real, it's the primary imperative of the doctor to show it and to convince a person of its truth.
You know, I think for family and friends of somebody who's very sick, there is the desire to be, you know, realistic and all that, but also the desire to just be the best cheerleader that you can, to just be as supportive and as hopeful as possible in the hopes of strengthening the morale of the person that you love?
I think it's very important. Again, you never know how things work out. People can have... I've seen many people who were handed death sentences, which I've also, in my training, done and regret deeply. Oh, you know, this disease, you have 3 months to live, or you have 6 months to live, and now it's a year and a half or 2 years. Or sometimes, and I've seen this several times in my career, a new drug or a new treatment arrives at a moment when it radically changes the prognosis. Look at testicular cancer in men. Recently, there are new antibodies for lymphoma, which is changing the remission rate and possibly the cure rate. Childhood leukemia. These were all diseases that were just uniformly fatal. And for those who were fortunate, a medication arrived in time. I used to have 12 to 15 people die of AIDS that I cared for a year. And then with the new drugs, it's not a cure of AIDS, but I've only had one person die in the last 2 years.
So that means you've had to change how you talk with patients about outcomes because the outcomes are so much better now.
The outcomes are better for many diseases, and there is a tremendous amount of research going on. So you don't want to hold out false hope and say, oh, yes, you know, there's a drug just around the corner and it's going to save you, because you don't know that. But you can say honestly that in a number of different diseases, breast cancer, colon cancer, a variety of blood diseases, there is such a concerted effort that perhaps if we can keep you in quality of life and in remission, a new treatment will arrive that really will make a fundamental difference.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He writes about medical issues for The New Yorker. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He writes about medical issues for The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. Some of the patients you've treated over the years have found, you know, strength and hope through prayer and faith. Other patients who you've treated don't have that to turn to, don't have faith or religion, you know, to lean on. You talk briefly about your father, and you say when your father was dying, he had like just a personal philosophy that he turned to, and I was wondering what that was.
My father was a free thinker. I was brought up in a home where there was both tradition as well as doubt. He didn't have a sense that there was necessarily an afterlife. None of us knows whether there is or there isn't really. But what he did feel, and he communicated to me, was that there was memory, that who he was as a person and what he taught his children would live on after he was gone. And he found great comfort in that.
So the way you describe it, it sounds like your father didn't exactly have a deep sense of religion to turn to, but he had some kind of larger personal understanding of life and death that he was comfortable with and that he was able to turn to put his own impending death in some kind of perspective.
He did. You know, I think people often assume that only individuals who are deeply religious can cope with facing their mortality. My father was remarkable. He was a man I loved very deeply. And he saw death as a natural part of life. I'm sure he was afraid of it on some level. But on the other hand, he had seen it. He'd been a soldier in the French front in World War II, an American soldier. His own father had died when he was relatively young. And he looked for ways to find strength and to find courage outside strictly of a theological framework. And he found it in memory, the power of memory, that who he was as a person and what he had taught his children would live on after him.
One chapter in your new book is devoted to your own story. You had a serious back problem in 1979. You want to just describe what your problem was?
Well, I had ruptured a disc, and I was a marathon runner. I was young and very impulsive, and went doctor shopping until I found a surgeon who said that he would fix me and everything would be set, and I'd be back doing sports aggressively, and he would fuse the lower part of my spine. And I underwent the operation, and I woke up, and I couldn't move my legs. And there had been a complication during the surgery, and for months I was in excruciating pain. And he basically said that this would be my fate, that the pain would subside somewhat, but that I would be severely debilitated for the rest of my life. And in fact, for 19 years, I lived that way. I lived as though I were inside an electric fence. Every time I would try to venture too far, walk too far, or lift one of my kids or something like that, my back would go into spasm. So this was the narrative that played in my mind. And then it turned out he was wrong.
Well, you went to see a specialist. And I love this part of the book. The specialist told you that you were worshiping the volcano god of pain. Who is this god?
Well, I saw a very brash, in-your-face physical medicine doctor, a physiatrist named Jim Rainville. And he swaggered in and he said, just what you said, Terry, you're worshiping the volcano god of pain, meaning that every time I felt pain, I would bow down and retreat, lie down and stop. And in fact, my interpretation of the pain was that it was danger and harm. But the truth was that that pain was reflecting the fact that my muscles had atrophied, my ligaments had contracted, and I had to disregard the pain. And I had to build myself up through a very gradual but persistent set of exercises to overcome the pain. And then, in an incredible way, my functioning returned, and I became largely pain-free, and I could live again. I felt I was reborn, and I stopped worshiping that god.
And this doctor also told you that you had to erase the memory of pain from your muscles. And I've read that in other places, that muscles and nerves actually remember pain in a way, and the more they experience it, the more good they are at activating pain real quickly.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I saw a paper in Nature, a very prestigious British scientific journal, about a year ago, showing in models of pain that there are actual changes in the circuits in the spinal cord and the brain, so that it's sort of this vicious cycle where, as you say, you keep imprinting in your mind and in your body these pathways of pain, and they become much more acute.
Now, you know, when I was reading this part of your story in your new book, The Anatomy of Hope, I was thinking about two things. One is, you know, were you going to have that ability to hope, to be hopeful enough to try the regimen that this physiatrist wanted to put you through? But also, were you going to have the trust to trust him with your body? Because you knew that you know, in the past, if you pushed too far or overexerted yourself, there would be consequences to pay. So if this physiatrist was leading you in the wrong direction, you'd be suffering consequences instead of getting better. And that issue of hope and trust, I think, are really intertwined. And it's difficult to put your trust in the hands of somebody you don't really know when the consequences could mean lots of pain.
Absolutely. And this doctor is very wise because he saw that. He could read it in my face. And in a very brash way, he said, you know, BS talks, but reality walks, meaning that I had to take the plunge and trust him, as you say. And I was very leery of this because I had suffered terribly. But what was interesting was that when he showed me that there was hope, when he said, here's a possible path, I felt at the same time this tremendous uplift. And I felt actually my body become more supple and I felt more ready. And every time I went through the program, which was very arduous, and I started to have pain, I would try to retrieve his words and retrieve the image of him towering over me as a way to spark hope and a way actually to dampen the pain.
So how has this experience with your own back and after 19 years finding a therapy that was effective for it, how has that affected how you talk with patients?
Well, it's shown me that hope can be very, very powerful. And it's also taught me that not only is there a mind-body connection, but there's also a body-mind connection. That when my body began to recover, my feelings of pleasure in life and my sense of hope were much more powerful. And so I try to support my patients through a difficult time physically. And when they begin to feel better in their body, you want a domino effect. You want that to be catalytic so that it can reinforce hope and that hope and that one looks to hope in a way to then give them the courage and the resilience to push to the end.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Jerome Groopman writes about medical issues for The New Yorker and is a professor at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and from BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we call Saudi Arabia and talk with journalist Faiza Amba. She's performing the Hajj, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, with her two sisters and is keeping a journal for the Christian Science Monitor. And David Bianculli reviews the updated version of Tanner 88, the pseudo-documentary about a candidate in the presidential primaries. It's being shown on the Sundance Channel. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 2 million Muslims from about 120 countries are now performing the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. Every Muslim is required to make the pilgrimage at least once if they are physically and financially able to. The pilgrims symbolically reenact events in the lives of the Prophet Abraham, his wife Hagar, and their son Ishmael. Performing the Hajj absolves the pilgrim from all previous sins, but only if the prayers and rituals have been performed with sincerity. Faiza Amba is a journalist of Saudi descent who's now making the Hajj with her two sisters and is keeping a diary for the Christian Science Monitor. On Sunday, about 250 pilgrims were killed in a stampede. Amba was at that site just a few hours earlier. Faiza Amba wrote for an English-language newspaper in Saudi Arabia for 3 years and then spent 5 years covering the Persian Gulf nations for the Associated Press. She now lives in Arlington, Virginia. We called her yesterday in Mina, a short distance from Mecca, where many pilgrims stay. Why did you want to make the Hajj? And I'm wondering if you are doing it more as a journalist or more as a religious seeker.
I started out doing it more as a journalist. I wouldn't have actually gone on the Hajj this year if I wasn't going to write about it. My sisters called and said, you know, we're going. Do you want to come? And they didn't really think I would join them because they know that I'm not very devout. But there was something intriguing about the idea of being with them and about writing about it. So I said, okay, fine, and I agreed.
And it sounds like maybe you've had a change of heart while you're there and it's becoming more of a religious journey than just a journalistic one?
I don't know what it is. I mean, we're sleeping 2 or 3 hours, you know, every 8 or 10 hours. Our days are upside down. And, you know, there's a group of us, 10 people together, among 2 million people, just praying and talking, you know, going through, listening to religious sermons and trying, you know, not to argue. Because it's part of the Hajj, part of a successful Hajj is not arguing, not gossiping. Thinking more, you know, letting go of the worldly and trying to become more spiritual. And I do feel something. I do feel a difference. I feel a lightness. I don't know if it's because I've been eating better, sleeping less, or because it's actually, you know, 2 million people praying and you're all together and doing one thing, moving from one place to another, all with sort of one goal.
2 million people is a lot of people. Would you give us a sense of the magnitude of the Hajj and what it feels like to be among 2 million religious pilgrims?
There's almost a festive air, like a medieval fair. It feels a bit like a medieval fair. I mean, Mina is not big. It's a valley. I mean, it's sort of partly enclosed by mountains. It's not a very big city, but there's asphalt roads and half of the asphalt roads have pilgrims actually lying down there with their mats, eating, sleeping, praying. So you've got pilgrims that are actually living outside in the open air. You've got cars trying to pass. You've got people walking, you know, from their tents to the jamarat, which are the pillars where, you know, you stone the devil. So It's really crowded. The only other time I've been in a crowd like this, but it was not of this magnitude, was when you go in or out of a concert. There's that human traffic jam where you sort of walk a couple of steps and just stop, walk a couple of steps and just stop. But here it's like people going back and forth, you know, all different nations. You hear, you know, all different languages. And, you know, a lot of it is out in the open air, and a lot of people are just living like that, so It's quite nice. I mean, we're very lucky. Our accommodations are very comfortable. But, you know, people just seem to be enjoying this religion. It feels a bit like religion camp.
Like religion camp? What did you do? Go ahead.
For example, in our camp, we've got a woman's praying room and a men's praying room. And every evening after sunset prayers, all, you know, you don't have to, but a lot of the men just sort of socialize in the prayer room and talk. There's a there's a cleric there, a preacher who gives a sermon. After the sermon, everybody who wants to ask a question, you know, they ask all kinds of questions. You know, is this blasphemy? Is this okay? The women ask questions. You know, is smoking permitted during the Hajj? What happens if a man looks at me? What do I do? So, in the separate praying rooms, you've got men and women with, you know, female cleric and a male cleric. So there's a social atmosphere as well. They play games. There's contests. They ask religious questions. So in that way, it feels like religion camp, in the sense that the lectures we hear are about religion, the contests are about religion, the sermons. But there's a social air to it.
On Sunday, there was a stampede that killed at least 244 pilgrims, and this was during the stoning of the pillars, which is a part of the Hajj. Would you explain what the stoning of the pillars is?
What I've understood is that it represents, it's sort of a reenactment of the prophet Abraham when he was asked by God to sacrifice his son, and the devil was telling him not to do it, and then he threw pebbles at the devil to tell him to go away, and then God replaced his son with a sacrificial lamb. So that it's a reenactment of that. But I just came back from there, and it's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun?
Yeah. It was really fun. I mean, it was really fun. There's something very child, you know, it's some kind of childish pleasure you get when there's, you know, thousands of you sitting there, throwing pebbles at a pillar representing the devil. I saw on the floor shoes and slippers. People had thrown shoes and slippers at the devil. So there's sort of a certain release when you're done with it that's quite maybe primordial. I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. My sisters and I came out like we just won, like our team had just won the Super Bowl or something. We were like, oh, wasn't that great? Oh, I feel so great. I feel like a $1 million. Oh, I feel much lighter.
But you know, if everybody's throwing stones and pebbles and shoes at these pillars, don't they also hit people?
I hit a couple of people when I first went, and I was so close today that I got a couple of stones in the back of my head, and I just smiled because I remembered that that's what I did.
Yeah, that's dangerous, isn't it?
No, that part is not dangerous. It didn't hurt at all. The dangerous part is that you've got so many people trying to do the same thing at the same time, at the same place, and it's very crowded, and you've got groups of foreign pilgrims who come 50, 60, 80 sometimes together, and they want to stay together because they don't speak a language. If they get separated from their group, you know, they're not going to find their way back among 2 million people, despite the fact that, you know, all the delegations have, like, flags stitched a lot of them have flags stitched on their costumes or their veils or their vests. But the scary thing is going there and getting lost. But the pebbles, I mean, I got hit by several pebbles today, and I did my, you know, by mistake, I hit a couple of people. That part is not, they're small because they have to be the size of chickpeas.
Uh-huh.
And you have to pick them from either Muna or Muzdalifa. And that, to me, that wasn't painful. And the dangerous part is when you got, like, groups who were trying to get in and out and stay together. And people going into very close to the pillars, which is where I was today, and trying to get out back in a crowd of, you know, tens of thousands of people.
Is that what sometimes leads to a stampede? Because Sunday was hardly the first stampede during a Hajj.
No, it was the worst one, but it wasn't the first one. The Jamarats are very, you know, very scary and very dangerous. And there's two levels. There's a ground level. On the ground level, there are three pillars, and then there's a bridge, and you can stone the same pillars from the upper level, which is where we went today. And under the bridge, there's an echo, and when you know that people have died here before, you get tense. It's kind of scary. And the first day I went, we heard an ambulance. It wasn't even nearby, and people started running. So, you know, a combination of huge crowds, you know, people are already scared. They don't want to get lost. They want to go ahead and finish this rite. to go home. It was funny. When I was going there today, I'm thinking, you know, more than 200 people died here yesterday, and still throngs were coming, you know. Huge throngs of people were just moving towards the pillars to accomplish their rights.
My guest is journalist Faiza Amba. She's currently performing the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, and is keeping a journal for the Christian Science Monitor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview we recorded with journalist Faiza Amba. She's currently with her two sisters performing the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. She grew up in Saudi Arabia. Now, I read that security is particularly high this year because of fear of a possible attack by Al-Qaeda, which has struck Saudi Arabia in the recent past. Is that something that you've been worried about?
No, I haven't. I know that that's a fear. I know that last week five cops were killed. I heard that they also arrested seven suspects recently. And I know that coming in and out of Mecca, there's been a heightened security. They double-check everybody. They check for IDs. But once you start sort of in the Hajj, I think... You really do leave a lot of the world behind, just trying to get your rights accomplished, listening to the sermons, trying to get some sleep.
After the stampede on Sunday, was it difficult for you or for any of the other people that you know or that you've met on the Hajj to maintain the spiritual focus, you know, knowing about the possible danger and also about the loss of so many lives?
Well, when I discussed the stampede with my sister, I was very, very deeply sad and touched by it because just the loss of life seems to me, you know, so terrible and so unnecessary. And I had just been there 6-7 hours earlier, and I was thinking, you know, did I see any of the faces that disappeared? Touched me because. Because even though there's 2 million of us here, I did feel a bond with those people. And I said this to my sister, and she said, well, it was their time to go. And, you know, God chose for them to die during the Hajj, and they die martyrs. But I still felt it was, you know, a very sad thing to happen. And it did scare us more. But, you know, it's the whole concept of Hajj, I think, is faith over human nature and faith over your instincts and faith over everything else. It's like, you know, people have died here, but this is the right we have to accomplish. We came here for the Hajj. You know, let's do it.
Is it considered an exalted death to die during the Hajj?
It's considered, yeah, they're considered martyrs if they die during the Hajj, because once you've accomplished the plain of Arafat, all your sins are totally absolved and you're back like a newborn. So they've gone straight to heaven.
What has surprised you most about the pilgrimage so far?
I was surprised a little bit by my own reaction to it. I'm usually quite stubborn and, you know, but I sort of decided to let go this time and enjoy it, and I didn't think it would get to me, but it has. I also didn't realize that there was... This kind of luxury was possible. I mean, I thought I'd be sleeping in a tent, and I'm sleeping on a bed. And we've got a buffet, and it's just very comfortable. I feel a little guilty.
Because other people are sleeping on the street.
Well, no, not because of that. Just because I thought I thought there was supposed to be a little bit more hardship in it.
Oh, I see. I mean, it like had, personal sacrifice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've walked long distances, and just going out and accomplishing some of the rites has been physically demanding. I mean, yesterday at the Kaaba, doing the Sa'i, which is a reenactment of Hagar searching for water for her son Ishmael, there were times when we couldn't move. I mean, we were just standing. We're supposed to, you know, do this walk in seven times, walk back and forth between the hills of Safa and Marwa, and there were points where we couldn't even move forward. It was so crowded.
Have a lot of people been talking about politics, and by politics I mean the war in Iraq, the United States presence in Iraq, or terrorism.
We had one discussion about local politics yesterday, and then my sister kept reminding us that that's not the spirit of the Hajj.
Right.
You know, we sort of had a political discussion, and we were, you know, each arguing what we thought about, you know, what's going on in Saudi Arabia and how that should be treated, and this the issue of terrorism and what needs to be done about that. And my sister reminded us three times, you know, she said, this is not what we're supposed to be talking about in the Hajj.
And
it really is. It's supposed to be a total spiritual immersion.
You know, this is a terrible comparison, but a secular and totally wild and different version of what you're talking about would be something like Woodstock. Do you know what I mean? Where there's like so many people coming together outside.
I swear to God, this is exactly what I was thinking as I was walking today.
Really? I was afraid to bring it up.
I said this out loud. I said to my sisters, you know, this is like a Muslim Woodstock. That's what it feels like, the sort of bohemian, sort of bonding, you know, groups of people, some are lying on the floor, you know, everybody's sort of doing the same thing, but doing their own thing at the same time.
Right.
You know, sort of a collective experience that's also very private and personal. And these were my thoughts as I was walking back from the Jamarat today, and everybody was sort of happy because we just accomplished the thing, and, you know, some people were going back, some people were still going, and I just thought, you know, this is a Muslim Woodstock.
Yeah, and experiences like that make you wonder, okay, if all these people can come together and get along and be peaceful and share a deep and common experience, why is it so hard to get along outside of that? Did you have that feeling that there's something very special and very wonderful, but that's probably like not going to last outside of the context?
Yes, and I think that's one of the things that they're trying to remind us. I mean, if, you know, this closeness that you feel now, this bonding, this getting along, this, you know, I mean, people here from over 170 countries, this is possible, this is how it should be. But I find it, maybe one of the reasons it's easy to maintain is because it is 5 to 6 days.
Right.
Maybe this whole spiritual immersion and forgetting about everything else is not possible for longer periods. I don't know, but it's really nice for the short time that it, I mean, and it's a first for me. And it's fun. I'm enjoying it, and I'm almost sad to have to see it end.
Well, thanks for sharing some of the experience with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry.
Faiza Amba spoke to us from Saudi Arabia, where she's performing the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. She's keeping a journal for the Christian Science Monitor. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the updated version of Tanner 88, the pseudo-documentary about a candidate in the presidential primaries. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
16 years ago, director Robert Altman and Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau collaborated on an ambitious TV series for HBO that created a fictional candidate for president and filmed him rubbing elbows with actual candidates, reporters, and citizens. That series was called Tanner 88, and it's back for a repeat run in this presidential election year. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Why watch a fake documentary series about a fake presidential candidate who mounted a fake campaign 16 years ago? I've got three very good reasons. The first reason is that, believe it or not, Tanner 88 is still relevant. 16 years ago, the Republicans controlled the White House, and there was a pack of Democratic hopefuls jockeying to outmaneuver one another in the early primaries and caucuses. The Democrats ended up running then against George Bush, just as they're running now against his son. The second reason is that Tanner 88 is great television. It didn't start out that way, because Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau basically were inventing the genre as they went along, and the first episode, which was about campaigning in New Hampshire and aired the night before the primaries, tried too hard and was too broad and satirical. But just as Jack Tanner, the fictitious candidate played by actor Michael Murphy, quickly found his footing and his voice and momentum, so did Tanner 88. The tone became a lot more serious and focused on the process of mounting a campaign and getting votes or failing to. After the second special, HBO committed to a series, and those 11 episodes will be repeated Tuesday nights on the Sundance Channel. It's the first time they've been televised since Ronald Reagan was in the White House. The three stars of Tanner 88, the ones who are paid actors, are Murphy as Jack Tanner, who looks and sounds a little like Gary Hart, Pamela Reed as campaign manager T.J. Kavanaugh, and Cynthia Nixon, now co-starring on HBO's Sex and the City, as Tanner's politically committed 19-year-old daughter, Alex. Other featured actors include E.G. Marshall and Harry Anderson, but the most fascinating supporting players in Tanner 88 are the real politicians Altman and his cast and crew encounter while trudging through the actual campaign trail. The fake candidate, Jack Tanner, shakes hands with the real Gary Hart and Bob Dole and has a lengthy, introspective conversation with Bruce Babbitt just after that real presidential candidate dropped out of the race. Years before the behind-the-scenes look at the Bill Clinton run for president was documented in The War Room, Altman and Trudeau were making it up as they went along on Tanner 88. And though the candidacy is fictional, the process was real. When a focus group laughs at an early Tanner campaign ad, the candidate meets privately with his staff and speaks from the heart about his message and motivations. His remarks are sparked by his opinion that none of the other Democratic candidates in the race that year, including Richard Gephardt, Joe Biden, Michael Dukakis, and Al Gore, got the answer right to a very simple question. Who's your favorite Beatle?
And there are those people who tell you that our noisy dissent, our raucous squabble, weakened us as a country, caused us to lose our supremacy. Don't you believe it? We are the envy of this world. Why? Because throughout our history, we have always maintained that we could do better. We've insisted that we could do better. We've always been willing to reinvent ourselves for the common good. And in our darkest hour, leaders, real leaders, have always stepped forward to hold the American people to the responsibility of citizenship. Well, it's time for that kind of leadership now, TJ. I'm not sure that it's me, but I'd like the chance to find out. Oh, and if you young people are still wondering, the right answer is John Lennon.
I promised three reasons why you should watch Tanner 88. In addition to its relevance and its excellence, here's number three. To update this Sundance Channel rebroadcast, Altman and Trudeau got together and filmed new openings for each episode, openings in which the three principal actors look back in character and reflect on the 1988 race. Altman has called Tanner 88 the best work he's ever done, and his enthusiasm for this is obvious. These new openings, written by Trudeau, are delightful, and they bring the series and the characters right up to date. Here's Cynthia Nixon as Alex Tanner, then Michael Murphy as her father, in one such new introduction.
I can still see him as president. I completely can. I don't know if you've seen the Draft Tanner website. The graphics are a little lame, although maybe not to a layperson. Anyway, I was talking to one of the founders, a graduate student of his, who's incredibly cute, by the way. I don't know what he's doing in graduate school, but he told me that everything is there for an independent run. Committed backers, the meetup capability, a campaign blog, flash mobs, all the key pieces. All we need is the candidate.
Has she gone mad?
Maybe it's not so crazy, but maybe it's just not the right time. People from show business seem to mount playful runs for the presidency at 20-year intervals. Will Rogers ran as a joke in 1928 until voters started taking him seriously. Howdy Doody ran in 1948, but he was just a dummy. In 1968, Pat Paulson from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour ran, sticking his toe in the same pond that Tanner 88 would dive into 20 years later. So maybe 2008 is the year for Tanner or for someone else. Meanwhile, let's take what we can get. Cast your vote for the Sundance Channel and Tanner 88.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Focus Features and Universal Home Video, presenting Lost in Translation, starring Bill Murray, now available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Carrie Fisher is best known as Princess Leia in Star Wars and as the author of Postcards from the Edge. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about her new autobiographical comic novel, in which an actress's husband leaves her for another man, and then she's diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.